Hello, I'm Preston Schlankofer. Welcome to Civil Defense Radio, where we discuss all things civil defense. Civil defense is about building community resiliency by becoming better informed, prepared, and organized to meet whatever disasters might affect you, your neighborhood, and your community. This week, we have an old friend with us, Matthew West. He's currently the Director of Safety and Risk Management for a school district in Texas, and that's the subject that we're going to be discussing today is emergency management in the school district. But before we get to Matt, let's cover something real quick. I wish to remind you that likes, shares, and comments on our shows helps us out a lot. It helps us out with higher algorithm scores, and thus it is easier for people to find us. Not only that, every show is about ratings and numbers. So the more you can help us out by liking, thumbs up, things like that on our Facebook and on the podcast apps that you use, the better we can get these numbers up, which are actually really increasing now since this Wuhan virus stuff has matured quite a bit. People are starting to come back to the podcast, which right after this thing hit, the numbers dropped dramatically. And so I thank you to those who are coming back. And we hope to keep you well informed and to some degree entertained. But also we hope to scare the crap out of you so that you not only prepare yourself and your family, but you tell your friends and loved ones about the need also. And that is one of our biggest missions, is to inform people about what they need to prepare for. So now let's get on with our show. Matthew West is a Director of Security and Risk Management at a school district. He is also a veteran law enforcement officer. He and I walked some of the same mean streets of South Texas, maybe not together at the same time, but we were there about the same time, and he knows the areas that I used to walk very well. So, Matthew, welcome back to Civil Defense Radio.
Thank you very much, Preston. It's glad to be back on the show.
It's a pleasure having you. Hey, I applied for this job very similar to yours. It was the Director of Safety for the school system in the county that I live in. And I got passed over for a candidate with a PhD, so I don't feel too bad. But I had some ideas about what I would do if I was selected for that job. And we talked briefly about it and came up with, you had some of the same ideas with your school district that you're employed at. Briefly, can you tell us what your duties are as the Director of Safety and Risk Management where you're at?
It would probably be easier, Preston, to tell you what my duties are not. They do not consist of. It is a very comprehensive job as far as here in Texas, schools are required to do security audits every 3 years. We also are in charge of doing threat assessments, student threat assessments. And this is something that's been developed not only through legislation, but also through Texas State University's Texas School Safety Center. They have really spearheaded school safety and have been working with the legislators and with best practices to bring the most comprehensive safety programs to schools in the state of Texas. So my job not only consists as emergency management coordinator, but also crisis planning on the risk management side of the house, anything from claims or claim reductions on employee injuries to emergency mitigation in case of some type of natural or man-made disaster. So it encompasses a wide variety of planning, just like a city or county or even national emergency management planner. It deals with all hazards. It deals with a community, really. Our school district has a motto of one town, one team, one family. And that's kind of how we view this is we are a huge stakeholder in the community, not only for students and staff, but for parents. I mean, schools have traditionally been the focal point of the community, especially in the last 20 years. From the 50s all the way up to probably the 80s, it was actually church and your extracurricular activities, 4-H, FFA, scouting, those types were the focal point for the community. But as times change and technology has changed, there's no longer that need for centralized, community gathering where parents used to get out and socialize with one another. And I think that's unfortunate because technology, social media has really taken the place and filled that gap, but it's not the same type of interaction that we need and that our students need. So schools have kind of taken over, not intentionally, but just through the course of technology and through just our changes in social life, have really been that centralized point for social skills building, for communication, and just for building a better person on top of the education platform. So there's a lot in our basket now that schools have to look at and when it comes to crisis planning. So there's the safety aspect, there's the security aspect, and there's the risk management aspect.
Yeah, there's a lot of buckets there that you have to sift through and try and get the right mix. It's a tough job, but especially in the school environment where you have multiple locations that you have to ensure, you know, consistency through all the various sites.
You're correct, and I'm fortunate in that regard. I'm in a small school district in a small town. It's a rural area outside of Austin, and we only have about 6 campuses altogether. But you start talking about Austin ISD, major school districts, and schools throughout the nation. There's some large schools that have hundreds of campuses and thousands upon thousands of students to take care of. And for those, you know, my hat's off to those emergency risk managers that have to deal with that at those schools because it's a big undertaking.
Yeah, it is. And there's a lot of planning that goes into effect. And since you've taken the job, you've probably had to make a few changes to meet with your management style and the vision that you have for the district, correct?
Correct. And I'm fortunate also to have a very good team to work with, from the superintendent all the way down to the teachers, to even our maintenance personnel or janitorial staff. You know, they're all very positive when it comes to safety and risk management. And they all believe that at the core of it, it's the safety of the students and the staff at the end of the day. And they're all willing to do their part, which makes my job a lot easier. And, you know, that's something that I really have to encourage, a lot of stakeholder ownership that, hey, you know, I may be the director, but in reality, I can't implement anything without the assistance of staff and students. So getting them on board is the priority.
Yeah. Well, part of that is the people that work directly for you in the individual schools, like the safety officers that are assigned to the various school sites or campuses, as you call them. From what I understood, the county here, all the campuses had their own safety officer at each location. So that would have given the director of school safety a staff to work with and use to progress that vision.
And in smaller districts like what I have here, a lot of times that role of the safety officer falls on a principal or assistant principal. What makes that a little bit difficult in mine is I'm not directly supervising that staff member.
Okay.
And a lot of smaller schools are like that.
I see.
But again, it comes back to the cooperation, and the safety team members are on board, and they're willing to listen. And, you know, we've had some security audits that we've done together, and, you know, they pointed out some things that I would have normally looked over, just because they have that working relationship. They're at that campus with employees, and they're intimately familiar with their campus. They know every nook, crook, you know, corner there is there. Mm-hmm. And so they're a wealth of information. And again, it comes down to training, for one. You know, they're willing to be trained, and they're wanting more and more training. Because again, they really like that role, because they feel that they have ownership in it, and that's very important.
Yes, and that is important, especially when there's a crisis and that facility has to be turned into a collection site or an emergency shelter. So their job expands even more during that type of situation.
Correct, and you know, we're running our own community. Granted, schools are, most people think of them as a Monday through Friday, you know, 7 to 6 p.m. type operation. And for the most part, that's true as far as the normal operational period is. But during that time, we're providing meals. We're providing limited health care. You know, even you think about it at the school nurse's office,
yeah,
you know, that is a first line of health care. Behavioral services, we're looking at it from a security standpoint, providing safety and security. We partner with our local law enforcement to provide school resource officers. Some districts have their own police department. Our district does not. But we do use school resource officers. So we have a partnership with the city, with the county, to provide those services. And you're right, when things go bad or go south, you know, a lot of times schools are directly affected, even if it doesn't affect the school itself. So you take a tornado, for example, comes through a community. A lot of times schools are going to be utilized as a shelter. So at that point now, it does become a 24/7 operation, and you have to be prepared to run meals, to feed the house, to provide showers and the basic needs for people of the community.
Yeah, it becomes a lot more labor intensive, and you got to care for your staff that are there providing for the people that are in the shelter, and so I mean, those people that are there in support of, they could have problems at home as well, because you know, unless they come from a long way away, they would probably be affected by whatever situation was the cause for those people to be needing a shelter. So there's a lot of going above and beyond in times like that.
You're absolutely correct. And it can get hectic. You know, most schools now are following them. Emergency response, multi-hazards models from FEMA, as far as incident command systems, NIMS, the National Incident Management System. So a lot of the training that principals and assistant principals are getting, as well as superintendents, are some of your basic incident command system courses, IS 100, 200, 700, 800. Those are some of the basic classes that a lot of school districts are implementing, that their supervisory staff, administrative staff take, so they can be familiar with the way public safety operations occur when there isn't an emergency.
Well, that's good, because they, if they're going to be operating in that environment, they need to speak the language and know how to act. And when fire department comes in, or you as the emergency manager says, we need to do this, they understand what needs to be done. And through exercises, they know how to implement those tasks and standards and policies. So that's you know, getting them to that point of understanding and being able to move in that direction is it's a big job too, especially, you know, like you said, some districts have more campuses than what you have, but even with six campuses, that's still a lot of cats to herd.
It is, and changing the school culture, the mindset of the way schools are run, just like any organization, you know, it's got its own culture, it's got its own way of doing things. You know, there's some things that, even though it's a governmental entity, you know, coming from the state government and coming to a school district, there are little things that are run different. And in some cases, I think they're run a little bit better, because you still have politics, but not as much, because the goal is more about students' education and safety. So with that in mind, you know, it's in the best interest of the school to provide for that. But when you have first responders showing up, firefighters, EMTs, on an incident, you're right, there is kind of a, well, what do I do now type approach when it comes to school administrators, because they're used to running their campuses.
Right.
They're used to being able to give orders, to give commands on what to do. But in a major incident, using the ICS system, you know, whoever that first responder, whether it's fire department, whoever shows up, they're going to take over that seat. And trying to explain to school administrators, you know, they're here, they're the professionals, this is what they do. You're still going to be the incident commander or the liaison officer, whatever your role is going to be during that incident. But you need to realize that you need to be at the command post. And that's something that I think probably my biggest obstacle in educating administrators is to understand that you can't be everywhere all the time. And if you want to be that person that's out in the classrooms or running around the campuses, then find somebody to be your incident commander, because that incident commander needs to be able to go to that command post, set everything up, and not leave there until the situation has resolved itself. And getting that through initially was kind of a new concept for them. But once I explained it to them and got some training done, a lot of them got on board with it, and they understand the reasoning behind it. So we've made some adjustments on who's responding to what and how they respond.
Right. So when you came into the position, there were probably some areas that were fairly obvious that you needed to work on, but there were some others that you have or had in mind that you wanted to implement. So can you give us some ideas of what some of the things were that you needed to change right away, and what things you intend to bring into the culture there in the school district, just to give our listeners an idea, so that, you know, if there's anybody out there who's in your type of position or in a school environment, then maybe they can start thinking about what a professional emergency manager would like to see in their school district.
Well, Preston, when I took the position here, this was a newly created position. There was no dedicated safety or risk manager for the district. Everybody had a little slice of the pie. That whole all other duties as assigned was divided between several staff members when I got here. So I had an idea of what needed to be done, but I didn't have an idea of what had already been done. And luckily, one of our administrators who was taking the role of school safety as part of his job duties, he's actually in our purchasing department. He's a Marine, so he had a little bit of idea of how things operate and chain of command and how to get some things done. And for not having the formal training for emergency management, I got to say he did a really good job. You know, the biggest thing was just getting everything organized, finding out where we've been and trying to do a plan of where we're going, how we're going to bring this all together. And a lot of that had to do with just sitting down with everybody Again, training is a big aspect of it. You can't go in into a school, into a high school, for example, and tell your principal and assistant principals, well, this is the way you got to start doing things now.
Yeah.
Our last legislative session really changed a lot on the way we operate. Several House bills came out, Senate bills as well. So the 86th Texas legislature came out with Senate Bill 11, and this is the school safety bill. And it talked about needing behavioral threat assessment models. We were already doing that before it became legislation. Our district was already doing that. So we were ahead of the curve on that.
So did they do that in-house, or did they contract with somebody? Okay.
No, we did that in-house. And the way the behavioral threat assessments work is if you get a threat, a student threat, whether it's going to be a school shooting or even if it's going to be a fight at the end of school, once we get that information, either before it happens or even after it happens, so you have a fight that breaks out, it gets broken up, students are then pulled in, and then they go through a series of questions to find out, one, how did the fight start? The whole who, what, when, where, why, and how.
Right.
And the purpose of that is, number one, to find out if there's any other behaviors. Has this been something that's been going on in the past? Is it something that's been stewing? Is it, really a bullying issue? And sometimes you find out that the person that in the fight was the aggressor had enough of it. The person they were fighting was the one that actually had been, either cyberbullying them or just, for a year now pushing their buttons until they finally decided to do something about it.
Right.
So by pulling in and getting the answers to a bunch of questions, we're finding out more and more that there's a lot more going on to it than, in the past, especially when I was growing up. You got in a fight, it was always, all right, either you broke it up or, the football coach way back in the day, you want to fight, here's a pair of boxing gloves. Some of that definitely would not happen in today's school environment. But, that model's changed and student safety is of the utmost priority.
Right.
And by doing these threat assessments, what we're finding is, through the course of these questionings and basically it's a mini investigation. Teachers are being reached out to, hey, how's the student's performance? If we see, the student was an AB student, now they're making C's, they'll start asking about that. What's going on in class? And a lot of times you find there's a lot of home situations. We found homelessness, we found abuse.
Right.
So I think the threat assessment model is something that has actually been something positive. It's started to bring things to light that normally would have been ignored. Again, it was, it's a fight over a significant other. Fights happen. And I think a lot of it was dismissed as that's just part of adolescence and growing up. And you're going to have conflict, you're going to fight, make up and move on.
Yeah.
And we're not seeing, that's not the case anymore. We're seeing that there's a lot more behind the scenes that needs to be addressed and resolved.
Okay. So what are some of the things you would like to bring in that probably need to be and make things a little smoother?
Well, in the overall emergency management overview, I would love to see a better continuity of operations plan or COOP plan. The School Safety Center has actually started requiring this as part of emergency operations plan. So now every school has to have an emergency operations plan. A lot of them didn't, especially the smaller districts. Like I said, a lot of them still do not have safety or risk managers to oversee their programs. So with this pressure from the legislature, with pressure from the School Safety Center, they're really starting to push continuity of operations. And this is something we saw as a result of COVID.
Yeah.
schools literally within a matter of weeks were uprooted and had to change their entire teaching model when, you know, kids were not allowed back in school.
Right.
And when I was working for the state doing risk management, I would look over a lot of continuity of operation plans for these different entities. And, you know, the pandemic plan really is one of those that they had one, they never exercised it. And the thinking behind that was it was all based on the flu. Most pandemic plans were preparing for H1N1.
Right.
Where it was, okay, we're going to have people out of work for 1 to 3 weeks, and then we'll be back business as normal. And I think now that we see that things have changed in this world, especially here in the United States, some of these continuity of operations plans weren't complete.
Yeah.
And again, there's a lot of schools out there that they've never even heard of continuity of operations plan.
Yeah, and that's unfortunate.
And a lot of it is, you know, everything in the past, with the exception of, you know, a building being destroyed in a natural disaster or a fire or something like that, that it has always been out of sight, out of mind.
Right.
You know, we'll deal with it when it gets here. And if it does, well, you know, we have other campuses. We can always shift students around, put them in a gym, put them in the cafeteria until we get the school rebuilt. But when COVID came around and now, you know, we ended up having to do telecourses, virtual learning, it kind of changed everybody's focus on, well, maybe we do need a plan for something.
Right.
And that's one of the things that I have really been trying to push for our district is to look at the broader scope to not only do more continuity, but more resiliency as well.
That's good.
The mere fact that so many schools are utilized as shelters, you know, really, in my own opinion, I believe that schools need to be equipped with generators,
backup generators and fuel, extra fuel. And,
yes. Yeah.
And it has to be on site. It shouldn't be a contract with a guy to bring some stuff if something happens. They should have enough fuel on site for long term. I mean, this crap about, oh, we've got a contract with this guy to bring us fuel after 3 days. Well, what if he's out and his trucks are out of commission and he can't get to you in 3 days? What if it's 3 months?
Exactly. And I think we have an over-reliance of contracting, and that's not just with the school system. I think that's
government,
yeah, but even private sector is we have this, I'll pick up the phone, I'll call somebody and they'll be here within our prescribed number of days for contracting.
Yeah.
And as we're learning now, our logistics chain is still running thin.
Yeah.
You know, the essentials, you know, food, milk, meat, you know, the shelves have been decently stocked, but you start looking for other things. I had to go buy bicycle tubes for my son's bicycle.
Uh-huh.
And couldn't find them. I went through 3 different retailers locally and their shelves were bare.
Wow.
And then we ended up, he learned how to patch a tire using the patch kit. which was good for him, but
yeah,
it made me realize that, you know, this is something that I think is going to sneak up on us. We saw this with the rush of medical supplies. Everybody went out, bought masks, gloves, sanitizer, and we're still feeling the hit on that.
Yeah. It's hard to find, Lysol spray still.
Well, and you realize that so much of our personal protective gear is not even made here in the United States.
Yeah, exactly. I think some of that is coming back.
Right here that says made in China.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah.
You know, so logistics is another thing. What happens when you're feeding, you know, we have roughly 5,000 students in our school district, give or take. So that's 5,000 mouths we have to feed every day, 5 days a week.
Yeah.
And breakfast and lunch for sure. And if they have after-school programs, sometimes we do even provide evening meals. But what happens when that food delivery can't get here?
Exactly.
You know, one of the biggest problems right now with the online learning modules or just the online learning system is we have parents, and this isn't just our district, this is nationwide, asking about, well, what about my kid for lunch? What about free and reduced lunches? Mm-hmm. There are so many out there that rely on the school systems to feed their kids. And our district actually has a fairly high poverty rate as well as a very high minority rate. And so these issues like that are real, and there are things that need to be addressed, because in some cases there are kids out there that will go without breakfast and lunch just because their family can't afford it.
Yeah.
And they actually do depend on the schools to feed them.
Yeah.
So when that logistics breaks down, how do you feed your kids? When your school staff gets sick, when the food service workers all have to be quarantined, how do you fill that gap?
Yeah. Well, we're this is a situation that is nationwide, and there's a lot of thought that needs to go into our school systems in a new dynamic and a big paradigm change here. But we're fast approaching a hard break. So, Matt, I thank you again for being on the show. And civil defense equals resiliency equals survival. The top-down governmental approach to solve our community resiliency problem has failed us. We need a community-based grassroots approach to solve this problem. To be resilient, it takes preparation, organization, and training to meet whatever needs your situation, whatever situation you may find yourselves in. Civil defense helps reduce panic in a disaster, and this is why we strongly recommend establishing a community-based civil defense organization in your city or county in partnership with your local emergency manager and community leaders. Let's start a conversation with the guide found on our resources page at civildefenseradio.com. It's right at the top of the page. Be sure to check out our regular postings on Facebook and Twitter, and our YouTube channel is Civil Defense Radio Podcast. Check that out. We're posting a lot of the older episodes there, and eventually we'll get caught up. But as I said before, I wish to thank our guest Matthew West for being on the show, and I wish to thank you, our friends who are with us on a regular basis. I really appreciate you being with us. So please be safe. Be informed, be prepared, and may God bless you and keep you until next time.